Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Derek Pernasiglio Show. I'm Derek Pernasiglio, and joining us today is the 1990 National Modified Champion, named one of the 50 greatest modified drivers of all time, Jamie the Jet Tomaino. Thank you for coming into the studio today and chatting with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, I always enjoyed stopping at your trailer, you know, over the years when I would pit report the modified tour races. Number one, because I always know that I can get some kind of great nugget of information from you. But what always used to suck was I had to leave right away because doing that job, you know, I had about, like, I would tell them, you got 5 minutes with everybody,
right?
You know, going there to the racetrack. So to be able to finally sit down and talk with you in this format is going to be great today. So, I mean, let's really just start off at the beginning. So you started at Wall Stadium, right?
Yeah.
And first year, what, in Sportsman's, right?
Sportsman car, 1974.
Okay.
Yep. I turned 18 on Sunday, and the race was Saturday. I went to the track. They wouldn't let me race.
Did anyone in your family before you race?
No.
How did you get the bug?
The track was only 5 miles from my house, and one day my mother dropped me off there, I guess to keep me occupied. And when I came home, I told her, you know what? When I get bigger, that's what I'm going to do.
How old were you at the time? Was she just dropping you off?
10 years old.
10 years old, dropping you off at the racetrack.
Oh, yeah. There was always a bunch of kids like that, a gang of kids. Matter of fact, I ended up being good friends with Parker Bone, Eddie Bone, and his whole family. Mm-hmm. And back then, if you were the driver's kid, you got in for the races for free. So even though it was still probably only 50 cents to get in, I said I was his, that's my dad too, when I used to go in with them guys so I could get in the grandstands for free.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, you never hear of like a mother just dropping their 10-year-old kid off at the track for the night. You know what I mean? That's just
yesterday on Facebook, I was reading a thing. One of my buddies, he used to hitchhike to Wall Stadium, which was about 10 miles from his house, to get to the races every Saturday.
Wow.
And then he would try to figure out how he was getting home after the races. But back then, that we kind of all, like, you know, that's how it was. You ride your bicycle, you go, and, you know, you got home when the lights, when it started to get dark.
And after that was it? You said, I want to race?
Yes, I said, I told my mother, I decided I'm going to be a race car driver when I get bigger. Even though I'm a pretty small guy, I excelled at sports, baseball, football. You know, I was really good, but I said, I'm going to be a race car driver. And little by little, my mom worked at a bar where all the racers used to come in after the races. So she got to be, once she told them my son wants to race, little by little, I kept on meeting more and more people.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So that got you familiar with some of the guys.
Yes.
How'd you get your first car?
My first car, a guy at the bar that my mother knew, he was building a car for Howard Harvey. This is back in 1971, I ended up driving for later in my career. He was building a car, and I used to go over there to see every day, you know, like what was going on. And I asked, I says, hey, when you're done with that one, could you build one for me too? And he agreed on it, and he built me the exact same car that he built for Howard Harvey, which was a dirt chassis Tobias car, which we ran on asphalt, which was a straight axle car.
Now, did you ever run dirt with it?
No, I never ran dirt.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I never got to run dirt.
So that was your first sportsman car, you were saying?
Yes,
right?
That was my first sportsman car. I ran a year and a half with that car. And the second night I ever raced, I had to race one the second night out, and I ran out of gas. And my father owned a gas station. And I ran out of gas. Yep.
Is that where you kept the car, at the gas station?
No, kept it at my parents' house my whole life.
Okay.
Yeah, yep.
So they were cool with you going racing? They had no problem with it?
Oh, no.
Okay, that's
good. No. My mom was 100% for me. Mm-hmm. When me and my mom ran out of money trying to put this car together, she said, I have to go ask my dad. He was livid. Livid. He was more mad because we were doing it behind his back, and we weren't up front with him the whole time. And when I got down to where I needed $400 to finish up something, he was really livid. And but, of course, he gave me the $400. And not only on top of that, once I started racing, he was my biggest fan.
Good.
If anybody ran into me, hit me, They would always say, "Where's Speedy? He's going to go kill the guy. Where's he at?" Yes.
But also, that was back in the days where you could make that 400 back if you won, right?
Oh, back when I first started racing, the money I made every Saturday night, I put away. Mm-hmm. There was no expense the following week other than it was $5 to get in the pits, mm-hmm. and you ran high test gas at the gas pump. But as far as the maintenance on the car and tires and stuff, there mm-hmm. was none.
That was the sportsman car, right?
Yes, but even in a modified car, there was way less, you know, there was hardly any expense. The tires lasted all year.
You were telling me, yeah.
I mean, all year. When I saw somebody putting a tire on one time, I said to my other, I wonder if I should be putting a tire on. That guy's putting one on. You know, I didn't even, you know, that's how nuts it was.
And you said, you guys were saying you could run a whole season on a set of tires. What did a set of tires go for back then?
$400. It was $400 for a set of tires, rims, and tubes, because we had to run tubes inside of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And tubes in the modified, too?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they weren't tubeless until probably the late 70s.
So your first year in modifieds was when?
It's 1976.
76.
Yeah, after the Turkey, I won Turkey Derby in the sportsman car, 75. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest race of the year. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was old enough to drink then. So we all went to the bar, and of course, in 75, Troyer, Bodine.
The bar your mom was working at?
Yeah. So all the big guys are at the bar. So I'm kind of like mingling in there, you know, that I'm going to, you know, next year I'm racing with you guys. And some people kept on saying, "No, you're not ready yet. You're not ready yet." And now here I'm like 19 years old because you had to be 18 to start. So I'm already 19. And I said, no, I'm going modified next year. I don't care what any one of you guys says. And I don't, on top of that, I'll probably whip some of your guys' asses too.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
They must have been looking at you like, really?
No, positively, positively. And then, so that 76 year, though, I struggled big time because the car that I got to go modified racing wasn't up to par.
Was that the kit car you were talking about?
No, this was actually a Trebway car I got from Blewett. I bought a used car from Blewett, which I thought was a thing to do, and it was ended up being the worst decision I ever made in my racing career. And then on top of that, my motor builder built me a motor that should have been in a drag car, because as soon as you hit the gas pedal, like the back tires would just shoot smoke out of them because it was 494 cubic inches.
Oh my
God. it was whatever. But as the year went, at the end of the year of 76, there was a race of champions race at Trenton, of all places, Trenton Speedway. Mm-hmm. And Howard Harvey I had just met, and he had a Saturday night car for Wall Stadium. Okay. And then he had this real special fancy car. I mean, it was looked like a rocket ship.
Right.
And Will Cagle was going to drive that car for him at Trenton for the Race of Champions.
You had to have, like, all the aero and all that, right?
Well, that's what they thought. Okay. So I asked Howard, "Can I bring your Vega car that you race at Wall Stadium? Would you let me bring that car? I like to run around that track. I mean, it's gigantic. It's big. I'd just like to go." He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Buy the tires for it." The tires were $400. You use the same set of tires the whole weekend and stuff.
Okay.
So we go to Trenton. There's 112 cars, I think, there.
That was one of them big open races.
No, this is Race of Champions.
Oh, okay. This is the Race of Champions.
Race of Champions, 1976, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I think there was 112 cars there to qualify.
Wow.
They took 60 cars in time trials.
Wow.
Yes. So when the time trials were over, this little kid, Jamie Tamano, was 55th.
Oh, okay.
I made the race. And
awesome.
Will Cagle in the rocket car.
Yeah.
Didn't qualify.
Yeah.
So Howard said, "Listen, they're going to have a warm-up later today. I want you to take that fancy car out." Because I'm 19 years old.
Okay.
I ain't got no scares at all, zero.
Right.
I says, "Man, this is unbelievable. I'm going to get to take this car out. Unbelievable." So I get out there, and I'm saying, "Well, Bob, where's Richie and Bodine? Where's Richie and Bodine?"
Right.
I says, "I'm going to hook up with them and run right with them."
Because you drafted back then,
Well, no, you didn't do none of that. You didn't know what the hell was going on.
Right.
You just kept it floored. When you're young, you just keep it floored and steer the shit out of it.
Right.
So when I when I saw them go by, I tried to stay with them. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, I crash.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I just crashed this guy's car that he just spent, like, you know, back then $20,000 on.
Right.
I said, oh, my Lord. But believe it or not, they had my other car that I qualified already running and mm-hmm. told me, get back in the car, go back on the track, get some more laps because we want you. We don't want you to have no nerves for tomorrow because what just happened and stuff.
Right.
That's so that cool. was my first race of champions in 1976.
Wow.
Yep.
You know, just really quick, a quick overview of your career. I mean, you've come up through, what, 4 or 5 decades of modified racing right now. 1990 National Modified Champion.
Yep.
Turkey Derby winner, yep, as well. One of the 50... greatest modified drivers of all time, one of the 50 greatest Stafford Speedway modified drivers of all time, I believe, as well. God, what else am I missing here?
Well, I won Martinsville in 83 before right. it was a tour.
Okay.
Yep.
Won
yep.
Martinsville also, in 83. Yep. Mm-hmm. And how many... God, Martinsville was always huge for all the modified guys back then. I mean, that was like the big race. It was like that race and Trenton, like... What yeah. was it like going to Martinsville every year, especially like during that era where you had the Evans, the Bodines, the Cooks, you know, all of them?
But there was one thing going down there to physically race, mm-hmm. but the best part about the whole deal, Martinsville, you were there all week. You weren't okay. there for a day or two. You were there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So you got to hang around with all your buddies, you know, and the nightlife was just unbelievable. I mean, it was just... It was the greatest adventure in the world. And we got to go down there in March, and then we got to go there in October, mm-hmm. twice a year. And then we had two smaller races in April and September also. So we used to go there 4 times a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was big money events, right?
Yeah, of course it was. Yeah.
For that time.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yeah.
First off, what was it like going to, like, someplace like Trenton, you know, just to jump back and forth. Like, well, Martinsville was a yeah. huge event. Trenton was also a huge event. Like, Trenton's not around anymore.
Right.
What was, because you look at that place from the air, you had to make a right turn down the back straightaway.
Yes and no. You could turn the wheel a little bit to the right, but if you went all the way to the left of the track, when you went down the back straightaway, mm-hmm. you could go straight through it. You didn't have to turn. Because of the angle. You got such a big angle that you could go straight through it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, believe it or not. That's the one track that I say to today, why nobody ever duplicated that track to the exact same configuration is beyond me. Because that thing was badass. Unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
I went there twice in my life. I was a little kid. Yeah. You know, my old man raced midgets, and he went to 2 ARDC midget races that were there at the time. And... when you're sitting in the grandstands, it doesn't look like that hard of a right-hand turn, you know, because you're looking at it laterally across the racetrack.
Right.
But when you actually got out there and rolled out there and we were leaving the place, I was amazed because, number one, there's also a light. There was a stoplight
right,
that hung over the corner.
It was way too low. Like, the first time I went by it, I thought I was going to hit it. That's how low they had the light. Yeah.
It was amazed the banking the place had, too, even through that dog leg.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Their 3 and 4 was really banked. And the only advice I got from Richie Evans was, the first time I went there, was when you go down the front straightaway, don't get out of the gas pedal completely, like, you know, because it'll erupt the car so bad. Try to be smooth and get out of it gently and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Back in the day, though, those were also when guys were building their own stuff. Like, you didn't have manufacturers like you do now. I mean, Troyer was around back then, but he didn't start until the late 70s.
No, in 76, he's already had his own fancier type car that he built for himself.
Okay.
Earlier than that, but still, in that particular year, like 76, there still was a lot of homemade built cars. Yes, correct.
Right.
Yes.
So, I always thought that time was so cool because... Being that you guys had to build all your own stuff to go racing, you got to see who the great fabricators were and who the beautiful car builders were. Because when you'd hear about somebody building a car, you'd know like how their skills, and you know, okay, they're gonna be building something really cool looking.
Yeah, but a lot of times them fancy cars, they didn't run worth a crap. Because as I got older and I got pretty damn good driving, mm-hmm. a lot of these guys had these crazy cars. Even old man Baldwin, he had a car that it was they called Zero Scrub, mm-hmm. and he was at Wall Stadium trying to get it to go around, and he was so pissed that it was terrible. And he got me, he goes, Tomato, get the hell over here. Get in this car and try driving this thing. Tell these assholes that the thing is terrible. I said, okay, let me try it. And I got out of that car. I said, Tommy, for once in your life, you're 100% correct. It's terrible.
Yeah. Tommy was a character.
Oh, he was great. Oh, great.
He really was.
Yes, yes.
What, you got any Tommy Baldwin stories besides that one?
No, he always just called me Tomato.
Tomato.
You know, Tomato, I'll kill you, you know, during the race if I got in his way or if I hit him or something, you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
yeah.
God,
but, you know, he was just, you know, one thing being in a race car, most people are different when you're inside the car and mm-hmm. your emotions and stuff. But, of course, out of the car, as far as the racing people, you know, he was golden, you know. Golden with all the kids, golden with everybody, you know.
Right. No, I remember because I used to deliver auto parts, one of my earlier jobs back in the day, and he had the auto shop.
Right.
And I had to go deliver, I forgot what kind of part it was that day, and I dropped it off, and they said, hey, you know, auto parts delivery's here, and he come out screaming and hollering, and, you know, give me these goddamn parts. And he slams his fist down, and he looks at me, and he cracks this big wise-ass smile, and they're all laughing, and I was... You know, you got to remember, I'm a little scrawny kid, and his big guy comes out yelling at you.
Yep.
And I knew his reputation from the modified racing. Right. So here I am thinking he's going to just tear me apart. And it's just, he cracks his big wise-ass smile at me, and everybody behind the counter just started laughing because they could see how, you know, how terrified I was.
Right.
Take me back to the early days at Wall Stadium. What was Wall Stadium like? I mean, God, you had so much... history there, so many laps there, and decades of racing there.
Yep.
You guys had your own, like I like to say, every track in that area had their own stars. You know, like Riverhead had your Jazombecks, your Harbecks, your Parks, your Baldwins, guys, you know, the local guys. Like
Wayne Anderson.
Wayne Anderson, Ganginelli, those guys. You know, Wall Stadium had, you know, your Gil Hearns, your Evernhams,
Siscone.
Ken Woolley, the Blewett.
Yep.
You know, what were those years like?
Oh, they were great. But the one of the things, though, as a young kid, I couldn't understand why hardly anybody from Wall Stadium ventured out to other tracks. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all like just racing there constantly.
New Egypt,
you know,
sometimes, right?
Well, yeah, but that's still right down the road. Mm-hmm. You know, matter of fact, even when I was younger, there was a racetrack in Atlantic City called Atlantic City Speedway,
right,
which Siscone dominated and stuff. And that was only a half hour probably from where the Jersey Shore was. Mm-hmm. I went down there quite a bit, but believe it or not, it was like I was an outsider from California when I went down there. They did not want you there. It was like, why are you coming down messing with our group of racers? We got our own gang. You're not invited to this race.
Well, they knew who you were from Wall, though, right?
Yes, yeah, okay. Of course. But it just was a different attitude, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you go to your weekly track every Saturday night, you got your, you know, same grudge matches constantly and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason I said, I don't want to get tied up in that. I want to go race other, you know, racetracks. There's a lot of racetracks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first times I went to Martinsville, Danny McLaughlin Sr. couldn't make it. He had his car ready to go. He goes, you want to go take the car to Martinsville? I can't go. I said, what do you mean? He goes, here's the truck. It's all, the car's on the truck. Here's your blank check. Go take it to Martinsville and try to qualify. I said, what? Okay, so I left. I don't even know if anybody else went with me. But then when I get down to the track, not even thinking, I ain't got no money. I got a check for some tires, which I don't even know if it's good or not because his reputation wasn't too hot. So I need gas for the race car. I got $3. Mm-hmm. So I pull over to the Union 76 pump to get gas. And the gentleman says, how much you want? I said, $3. He goes, son, you don't have to pay for the gas down here. I said, in that case, fill it up.
You didn't have to pay for the gas?
No, you never did at Martinsville.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Union 76 never made
paid
for gas.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so not only did I get a full tank for my race car that day, I also got to fill the ramp truck back so I could at least make it halfway home if things didn't work out.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how'd you do in the race?
I like to probably blew up. Back in the early days, the motors blew up a lot. Yeah.
Oh, God. So, all right. So let's go get back to Wall, though. Wall, You ran your first year and a half in Sportsman, then moved over to the Modifieds.
Yeah.
You got a car from Blewett.
Yeah.
You said John Blewett Jr. or
Senior.
Senior.
Well, he's the money man, so he's the one that...
Okay, but it was yeah.
One of Junior's cars that he bought from Don Kramer, believe it or not.
Okay, so it was one of the 76
It was one
cars.
Of the 76s. And I can see why they sold it, because it was a piece of junk.
Was it one of the Gremlins? Or
no, this was a Pinto Trebway car.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And Wall, I had always thought, was like a miniature Dover, in a way. It really was. Or a small Bristol. Yep. High-banked, you know, high-banked in the corners, even banked down the straightaways,
right.
too. I mean, you just slung it in there. I mean,
yep.
it was a wild place to race. Mm-hmm.
Once I qualified for that race for Trenton, mm-hmm. for Howard Harvey,
mm-hmm.
and he realized that I wasn't too scared about anything,
mm-hmm.
that I started driving for him, so I didn't have to worry about a car and stuff.
Okay.
So I ran for Howard in 77 and 78 and 79. I won my first modified feature in 78 with Howard Harvey's X9 car.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was the Vega?
Vega cars, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, all Vega cars.
Okay.
Yes.
Ideal Kitchens, right?
Ideal Kitchens, yes.
Was the sponsorship.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Howard could always, he was always a good businessman between the car dealership or the
kitchen. Well, he
actually
had the kitchen was unbelievable. He had a beautiful place in New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
that he did well in.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of like used, he fired me in 79 and then Tony Hirschman drove for him. Then he got rid of Tony Hirschman, and then I drove for him again.
Okay.
Then he got rid of me, and then somebody. It was a, then finally in the '80s, he got so mad at me over something that he put Blewett in the car. He thought Blewett was going to be able to beat me at the bigger tracks. I excelled at the bigger tracks more so than the smaller ones. But but to make a long story short, you know, Howard was a great owner, but he had a lot of different guys drive his cars.
Yeah. Now, at what year, like, did you move over into the 99 car?
That, 1984. Yep. I won Martinsville for Howard Harvey.
Okay.
In the 09 car.
Mm-hmm.
And after the race was over, because of that grandfather clock,
mm-hmm.
that made problems.
Really?
Well,
both wanted a clock?
Well, they only give you one.
Right.
And,
well, nowadays you can order another
one.
Well,
of course, that's what he ended up doing. But it caused enough riffraff that actually I won the race and got fired the following week.
Really?
Yeah.
Over the clock?
Over the clock.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did that go down? Like,
it was terrible. I mean, we went to the Dutch Inn after the race was over to celebrate, and it was it went from the best day of my life to the worst day of my life.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just terrible.
You all drinking around the bar and got into an argument over the clock?
Well, just who's getting the clock? I mean, that when it's my, I won the race, it's my clock.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't go good. It just, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah. So then that was the end of me with Howard Harvey in 1983, at the end of that year,
mm-hmm.
and 1984 started, and I didn't know really what I was going to do for a fact, and I was always used to taking care of my car myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was always hands-on with my car. I knew exactly, if something happened to it, it was my fault,
mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying? And I struggled during that year trying to get rides and stuff, and nothing really ever panned out.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Richie Evans sold the car to a gentleman called the Captain Doug Lutz. He was from New Jersey. Richie Evans got a hold of him and says, basically, you can't drive. You're not a driver. Jamie doesn't have a ride. Give him the car. Let him drive it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did. I finished second to Ciscone in the Garden State Classic. I ran up front with it. I didn't get it to win with the car, though, but I ran up front with it.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up becoming Mario Ferrari's 44 later that year. I had a fan out of the grandstands at Wall Stadium. His name was Bill Potts.
Right. That's
okay.
That's the guy I remember you driving for,
Bill Potts,
for a lot of years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and at the middle of 84, he wanted to know why I wasn't racing like at Oswego and here and there anymore. And I told him what happened. He says, so I'm going to come over and see you. at my shop. I said, okay, yeah, come over. Yep, you know, you always, there's always people that always tend that they're going to help you or this or
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, they talk, you know, a big game. Yeah, right? I'll come help you. And next thing you know, you're working in the shop alone.
Yep. Well, one day, all of a sudden, a black Porsche is driving down my driveway. I says, wow. I said, this guy showed up. And we started talking. And he goes, I want you to go to Oswego next week. I says, well, the guy that I got the car from, he ain't got no extra, you know, money to do any of that kind of stuff. He goes, I'll take care of it. I just want you to go. I want you to go. And so I was able to do some of that. And then I convinced Bill Potts into becoming my car owner. So he ended up being my car owner from 1985.
Right.
Up until
That's awesome.
1989.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because I remember a lot of those years, of course, you know, you driving that white and orange number 99 car,
right,
you know, for Bill Potts. You know, and it's the other thing that's funny, too, the other part of that conversation, the other modified people that we've had on the show, they always talk about some of those kind gestures that Richie Evans did for them.
Yeah.
You know, Brett Bodine was telling us about it, and Reggie was telling us, you know, other things, too. But there were so many of those little things that Richie did over the years that people didn't know about, like, until guys like you come along and tell us these stories.
Right.
You know, how was Richie, you know, to race? He didn't come to Wall that often. I heard
he didn't
like Wall that much, but what was he like with you?
Oh, he was just a regular guy. He was just, you know, you got to remember, he was young also, you know. It wasn't like he was, like, way older, you know what I'm saying? So it was like all one big gang. But the biggest difference in a racing back then and now is there's none of that go in the corner and don't turn the car, just leave a floor till you hit the guy and knock him out of the way. There was zero of that.
It was more respect.
Zero. There was never, ever any of that kind of stuff, you know?
Using a guy up.
Yeah, that, you know, nowadays if you're leading, you're almost screwed if the guy's behind you.
Yeah.
Because nobody cares. Just keep it floored and crash him. And there was none of that back then, you know, zero.
Well, a lot of guys also had to work on their own stuff and you know, pay for their own stuff,
true,
too. So I think that probably has a lot to do with it. Is that one of the biggest things that you've seen come along in your career? I mean, for the decades of modified racing you've done?
Yes, positively. Mm-hmm. Yeah, positive.
Looking back, though, at knowing then what you know now, looking back, what do you think was one of the areas in modified racing that could have saved everyone money?
That could have saved everybody money?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, just start, for instance, set of headers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's stainless steel headers,
mm-hmm,
and there's mild steel headers. The stainless steel headers are twice the amount of money. Well, if nobody has stainless steel headers, we all got mild steel headers. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? So, I mean, just like we had a problem with non-quick change rear ends in the modified.
Mm-hmm.
When they let us go to the non-quick change rear ends, you needed 5 or 6 rear ends. And then every week, you would have to change the whole rear end in a car, mm-hmm, not just the gears.
Right.
And I fought for that for years, mm-hmm, till they finally came to their senses and threw that out and stuff, you know.
You've worn out NASCAR officials on rule changes, haven't you, over the years?
Yeah.
I'm sure you're not their biggest fan, right?
No, I'm not. No, positively not. No. Good Lord, no. I mean, there's always different, you know, no different than with shocks. You know, there's shocks that cost thousands of dollars, you know. But I guess there's more and more rules. So more rules cost more money to do stuff.
Right.
Yep.
Now, what is it that you have more modified starts than anyone on the tour of all time? You are considered the Iron Man, right?
Yeah, well, the NASCAR told me when I made my 600th start.
600.
That was 600. It's over that now, like 630, 640.
Wow.
I was the highest person out of every division other than Winston Cup.
Really?
So there was only 6 at that time. There was only 6 other guys that had made over 600 starts in Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 600 starts in a modified car.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yep.
And you know, you're probably, I think, the only guy that was left, that's left, that's been around since the tour's inception.
Yeah.
That 1985 year, or at the end of 84, when they were announcing a Winston Modified tour where you guys were going to have a series. What did you guys think? Was everyone excited about it, or was it one of those?
No, it didn't pan out. In the beginning, it didn't pan out because all the weekly tracks were still running. You had the Parks running, you know what I'm saying? You had Shangri-La running. You still had Modified tracks still racing every Saturday night or Friday night or whatever their night was. Mm-hmm. So a guy like Mario Ferrari, he didn't start running the tour till later in the 80s constantly.
Right.
Little by little, when the weekly tracks went away, they had no other choice now to run the tour because the weekly tracks started faded away.
But you did. You ran the first season of the tour.
I never missed a race up until I stopped running. I moved to North Carolina in 2017.
Okay.
Never.
Okay.
Yep.
What was it like just seeing like the evolution of the Modified tour over the years? Because I used to remember as a young kid, races would count towards national points.
Points, right.
You know, like, yeah. So there would be like a national race that would come to town at Islip, and then you'd see the guys like Dick Traynor, Jerry Cook, Richie Evans, you know, all those guys that would come from all over. Then the tour comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You started racing on the tour.
Yep.
What was different about it compared to like going to those national points?
Well, I would have to say Jerry Cook had some influence, as far as I know, on the Whaler Modified Tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he finally realized that him and Richie are killing themselves trying to race Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and wherever the race is going to be at. Mm-hmm. So I think that he's the one that said, enough of that. If we want to keep on having cars and stuff, we need to have this touring series, and there's just one race a week, a month, or whatever, and that pays the points. So we ain't got to go through this craziness no more. Because if you look back at time, I think basically there was only two or three guys that would probably do an abundance of the national championship
point races.
So
right.
It was Jerry Cook and Richie.
Right. I used to hear
saying?
Stories of them being up at Shangri-La or Stafford, and the next day they'd race down to South Boston or Bowling Gray or something.
Right.
That's a haul, even for back then.
Yeah. So, and nowadays, guys, they need a whole month to get their car ready for the next race, where back then they were running five times in a row.
It is obviously the money is the biggest thing. But you could race back then a couple of times a week with the same car, same motor, same tires, same everything.
Yes.
You know, do you think we need to get back to that? Or is that one of these things that we've already we can't engineer?
It's long gone.
Yeah.
Long gone. That's unfortunately. I mean, the young guys of today, the top runners, Bonsignor,
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't believe that when I used to go to the races that there was five or six different tire companies at one race.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Firestone.
You know, Hoosier, you know, McQuarrie, Goodyear, you know, and you had your choice of what, and then each tire company would have 5 to 10 different compound tires. You know, nowadays you got a tire, and that's it. Everybody runs the same tires, same thing.
But isn't that a good thing, though?
No, it's terrible. Ruin the racing.
Really?
Ruin racing.
Oh, okay. I would think that that'd be level the playing field. Everybody's got to run the same thing, and, you know, you set the car up to where the tires that you got.
Yeah, my opinion, have ruined it.
Wow.
Yep,
okay.
Yep.
excuse me.
Yep.
So you ran all of those big races back in the day. Like, you ran, like,
I got to go to Dover. I got to go to Dover in 1977. It was called the Atlantic Coast 300. That's the race Troyer got sick, and then Bodine had to get in his car.
Really?
And to finish the race and stuff.
Now, was it one of those big races back then where 100 and something cars would show up?
No, because it was a race that didn't get much promotion,
mm-hmm.
and there only about 30 cars showed up, and hardly any fans showed up.
30 is not bad, though.
Yeah, but,
For nowadays,
right,
it is.
Yeah, I left Wall Stadium after the race this Saturday night. We went right there, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And my wheel bearings ended up seizing up on the car because the banking was so steep and you could keep it floored all the way around the track that physically my bearings all seized up.
So the load from getting in the corner?
Yeah.
Did the place scare people? Was it too fast for some people?
I would say, nah, There weren't too many scaredy cats back in the day.
I couldn't imagine what Dover was like in a modified. Yeah. You guys must have been flying.
Yeah, the only one that was completely nuts was the big Pocono track. Mm-hmm. And once again, I was so young when I went there. My steering wheel was 17 inches in diameter. I'm holding on to the steering wheel with dear life. And I'm going 150 miles an hour, which was fast.
Right.
And Bodine and Evans come flying by me like I'm sitting still. And I said, how in the hell are they going that damn fast? You know, I got a death grip on my wheel, holding on for dear life. And they just went by me like, you know, I'm standing still.
Right.
So that was a sight, a track to go to.
An eye-opening experience.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. I never got to go back there with a better type car, because I had an older type car when I got to go to Pocono also.
Okay.
Back then. But I was one of them guys back then. I just wanted to go. It didn't matter. I knew I wasn't going to beat Richie and Jeff back then.
Right.
But thank God I went, because a lot of the tracks ain't even around no more.
Right. I was just thinking about it. Like, you ran at all the cool tracks that are not around anymore.
Right.
Like, you ran Islip, right?
Yes. Yep.
Nazareth.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, great track. Great
like,
track.
How was
that track? That track scared people there. There is a track that actually scared people in the 90s when we went there. A lot
Why
of
is
guys,
that?
Because of the speed. You could keep it floored from turn three all the way through the dog leg in the front straightaway all the way to turn two, I guess you would call it.
By the bridge?
Under the bridge.
You okay. Could,
yeah. As a matter of fact, during time trials, we all used to stand there because everybody has big balls. You know what I'm saying? And they said, we're going to see who's telling the story, who could lift or not lift. You know what I'm saying? Whether they burp it or not.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. And Steve Park, he would have been a good one to tell you, because I think he went through there full bore, but he caught the wall. Mm-hmm. And ripped his right front off, I think, if I remember or not. But God. That was a beautiful, badass track, positively, yes.
Really?
Yeah, that makes me sick when you see stuff on the internet. That, you know, how
the track's overgrown.
Just terrible.
And there are places that you race that, too.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. Yeah, just terrible. Yeah, but my favorite track out of everyone that's not there no more is a 3/4 mile Pocono Speedway.
Okay.
Yeah, that was probably one of my favorite tracks, and they took that away to build garages.
What was it that you liked about the 3/4 mile track at Pocono? Because, I mean, I remember it. It was just a flat track where they cut turns into the infield.
Well, once again, the atmosphere of your big race during the season, mm-hmm. when you can go to a racetrack and you can not only it's the biggest race of the year, but you also can go there for 3, 4, 5 days to have fun with your friends,
right.
with your other competitors, mm-hmm. and do stupid things at nighttime and stuff.
What kind of stupid things?
I mean, there's plenty of stuff. I mean, you name it, we did it.
All right, come on.
No,
Steve.
Good.
Come on.
Oh,
tell us a story.
Oh.
That's what we're here for. This is the table of truth, man. This is where we, you know.
It was always ugly. It was always ugly. You know, saying most of the time we never got back. If we got back to the motel room the next day, most of the time we just went straight right to the track and stuff. Yeah.
Race with a hangover and everything.
Oh, my Lord, mercy. I remember getting hit in warm-ups one time because I wasn't 100% yet.
Mm-hmm.
I went over to the guy. I got out of the car and I says, are you completely crazy? It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Why would you be hitting somebody already? I got a headache still. You know? Yeah, it's way too early to be doing that.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the key to big races. Like when the shootout down they had down here when it
at
first
Concord,
started.
The North South shootout. Mm-hmm.
The nightlife, the atmosphere, and everything is part of the excitement of the whole deal.
The experience.
The whole thing. It all adds up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And all them big races had plenty of that. Thompson 300. You were there for 3 days.
The World Series, too.
Yep. You have the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need that extra excitement. To, you know, it's just a great time.
Do you think that that's what some of the promoters need to kind of think of when they're having some of these events again, some of these other amenities? I mean, obviously, a lot of the tracks we go to are 20, 30, you know, even 40 years old. But do you think there are some things that some of those promoters should think of, maybe like live music or something like that for after the races or something?
Would
increase the atmosphere?
Nah. I mean, the biggest thing they got now, of course, is, you know, you're camping, which everybody enjoys and mm-hmm. stuff. It's just a different time and era, you know what I'm saying? Like I tell everybody, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I grew up in the best areas are modified. I guess I'm 65 right now. Mm-hmm. If I was...
And you're still racing,
and
too.
And I'm still racing.
Right.
I missed out on, like, Langhorne. Like, my time span was almost 1,000% perfect. Mm-hmm. I'm probably, like, you know, 900% perfect because I missed out that little error there.
Right.
You know? But as far as my racing career, I wouldn't change a thing, you know?
Right.
I've always been able to be my own person. Mm-hmm. I could say what I want, do what I want, get up when I want, do everything the way Jamie Tamana wants it. I don't have to listen to nobody. And a couple times I got fired from Bill Potts for being that person. But in the long run, we ended up back together anyway.
Okay.
So, you know, so I've enjoyed my whole life racing.
So Bill was around for a while. You drove for him. I remember the car vividly. Did Bill stop driving after Tony...
Believe it or not, that's that year Tony Jankowiak passed away. Mm-hmm. That's the year I got fired.
Oh, okay.
So he took my ride in the 99 car.
Okay.
And after Tony passed away, then he took a little bit of time off, but then he started back up again in the following year racing again.
To Tim Airy, I think.
Airy drove for him. Stefanik drove for him, believe it or not, a couple races and stuff. Okay. And then by 1992, he was... back calling me up, and we hooked up back up again from 1992 mm-hmm. to the day the planes hit the World Trade Center.
Oh, okay.
He called me when the second plane hit, and I never heard from him again. So I thought for sure that he had something had bad had happened to him because he was that close to the Trade Centers, his business in New York.
Really?
Yes. And he didn't pass away, thank God. And the following week, he called me up and said, "I'm done racing. I got to do other things in my life. I've been lucky enough to do this with you all for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. I'm going to enjoy my life doing other things now."
Wow.
Yep. Okay. So, yep. Mm-hmm. So that's how that physically ended. But during that span, though, I had met a guy named Joe Venetian from Perth Amboy Spring. I was going to Shangri-La to race on a Saturday, an off weekend from the tour. Mm-hmm. As I pull in to get gas at a gas station, I got rear-ended the same time I stopped at the gas pump.
I remember that, and the whole hauler went up, right?
Well, my truck flipped on top of the gas pumps. The tractor trailer pushed my trailer, and I had a fifth wheel. It flipped my truck on top of the gas pumps and exploded.
Wow.
Now, when I say exploded,
I remember.
There was nothing left of the gas station. There was nothing left of the truck, nothing. Somehow, though, me... two guys and my little son Trey got out of that truck with basically nothing happened to us.
Wow.
Like God like grabbed us and said, "You're not dying today."
Wow.
And blew the whole place up. And I met this gentleman, Joe.
So did you guys get out of the truck and then
it went up
in flames?
No,
or
we
it
were
blew
inside the truck when it flipped over. When it flipped the truck over, we were in the truck. I thought I was on a roller coaster when it happened because of the sensation of I had flipping upside down.
Right, right.
But somehow we got out before the tense flames, the blow up, and
overtook,
everything else overtook us.
Wow.
Yes.
So I remember opening up
the racing paper. It was a big
Gator
thing.
Gator Racing News, yeah. National Speed Sport News, Area Auto, and the pictures were in there.
Yes.
I mean, it was just, you know.
Devastating.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
But not only did I lose everything that day, but at the same time, I met one of the greatest guys in helping me in my racing career was this guy, Joe Venetian, mm-hmm. Perth Amboy Spring. Mm-hmm. His father had sponsored cars from the 50s. Mm-hmm. And on this particular day, when he found out what happened, he came to help because they had nowhere to take all my stuff. And his business was only miles away. And he came over and said, "You could have them bring all that over to my business and we'll store it here until the insurance companies and stuff can get there."
Now, the truck was a complete loss, obviously.
It melted right to the ground.
Right. Now, what about the trailer, the race car hauler?
Everything was completely gone. Half of the race car were salvageable. We had to cut it off at the front end.
Wow.
But everything else was a total loss.
Wow.
But by all rights, if the pictures... we shouldn't be here.
Right.
Yep.
Remember, it was the tractor trailer driver fell asleep at the wheel, right?
He got cut off. His thing, he got cut off. So their insurance company said there was another Phantom car, which, you know, trying to go through all their insurance and stuff was a, it was a kind of a pain in the balls, but it wasn't a pain in the balls that they, you know, what I lost, I got back all new.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was fortunate enough. I was alive, you know, to tell the story.
Right. Yep. Yep. Yeah. That's the big thing.
But the only other crazy, when I hear a quick crazy story was, I was going to Flemington to race with my buddy, Sat Savage.
Mm-hmm.
He worked at IROC at the time. He wanted me to drive his car at a race at Evergreen. And this is in the 90s.
I remember Evergreen.
You know, so I used to freelance a lot also with other guys and stuff. So we leave his house in Jackson, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We get about halfway, almost to Flemington, which would have been about halfway to Evergreen Speedway.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, listen, pull over. I got to pee. Because we left at around 5 o'clock in the morning when it was dark out.
Right.
I said, pull over, I got to pee. I get out of his truck. I go to the back of his open trailer. And I walk back there. I grab a hold of the fender. I start peeing. There's no race car. You know how, like, when you're peeing and then all of a sudden, like, you're in a shock and you pee all over yourself. You know what I'm saying? I swear to God. I zipper my pants up, and I'm still got to go.
Yeah, right.
I run to the side of his truck, and I said, where's the car?
Right.
I said, we loaded it up, right? He goes, yeah. I said, well, there's no car. It's gone.
Where's the car?
It was gone.
Where was it?
Nobody
tied it down?
It was tied down, but somehow it flew off. And he's driving the truck and doesn't realize we lost the car.
Oh,
how
shit.
Could you drive and not know you lost the car?
Right, you feel it on the trailer.
You would think, well, we drove over an hour, because when we finally found it, it was an hour behind us. And I thought for sure it flew off and it was gone. It was sitting in the middle of the highway at a red light. Swear to God.
Did it rolled off the back of the trailer, yes, as you guys took off?
Somehow or another. Now, if I didn't stop to pee, we would have went all the way to that track and got there with an empty trailer. Swear to God.
Thank goodness for your bladder, right?
Yeah. Yes. So we turned around and went back. The cops had it all coned off the car. Nothing happened.
You guys didn't get in trouble? No ticket or nothing?
Not there. Everybody thought it was hilarious.
Oh, God.
Yeah. In the meantime, the guy thought he killed somebody. He says, the car probably flew off, killed somebody. I'm going to jail. I need a tranquilizer.
The car wasn't wrecked? No damage or nothing?
Nothing. Because the open trailers were, like, some of them were real low to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it rolled right off, and we rolled it right back on like nothing ever happened. But it did happen. I'll never forget that guy's face when I told him the car is gone.
So how'd you run that night?
Huh?
How'd you run that night?
We ran good. We finished fifth in the race. Yeah. But can you imagine showing up to the track with an empty trailer,
right,
and they want to know what you're doing?
Right.
Are you here to buy a car?
Nobody. You didn't look in the mirror? Couldn't look in the rearview mirror?
Once again, we left at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was dark.
Oh, okay.
I was in the back seat sleeping. You know what I'm saying? So the guy driving should have realized he lost. Not me. I'm in the back seat.
This is great.
Yeah.
Now, going back to those times, or actually even before those times, I'm sure you've got to have some funny stories of, obviously, back in the 70s, I don't like to use the word cheating. I like to use the word innovating. Guys were developing things. Or what were some of the things that guys got busted with, or that guys were trying that they were cheating with, or innovating with, I should say?
I don't know. One of the things when I started running Super Duper at Wall Stadium, and every Saturday night people would always come over snooping around looking at the car and stuff. I finally
like
got...
Like racers do.
Yeah, like racers do. I know what I'm going to do this week. I'm going to make up, I got to get some aluminum 2x3, and I'm going to paint it white, and they're going to think it's my lead, and I'm going to put all that lead looking on the right side of the car. I'm going to stack it so it's on the opposite side of the car. Yeah, and then I used to see the people just shaking their heads, couldn't figure out why would you have all that lead on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I did that, then I tried to make a trap door where I physically could move the lead from to make the left side weight,
mm-hmm,
that I could have something that would slide it back to the left once I went through the scale and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because back then, everybody was, the more left side weight you could have, the better. Mm-hmm. But of course, as the years went by.
Now, wait, hold on. Just really interject really quick. That sliding the weight, that was actual weight. That wasn't hollow.
Oh, yeah, that was tubing. Real. That was real lead. Yeah.
Okay, so you were sliding the weight back and forth in the frame?
Right. Not in the frame. I actually made a track so you could, I could pull it like with a string, mm-hmm. pull it over, then pin it. So I had it on a slider.
What, down by your left
yeah,
side?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
How much weight was it?
50, 60 pounds.
Really?
I mean, yeah, back then, like, people used just to throw the lead right in the compartment with you. Like, it would have been bolted down. Nobody yeah. was feared of dying, you know? There was no fear.
No, I remember we used to take, when my brother was running street stocks at Riverhead, we would take a Cadillac, a valve cover. No, okay. Cadillac valve cover.
To pour the lead in.
Pour the lead in, yeah. Because filling one up was 50 pounds.
Right.
Filling one up with lead was exactly 50 pounds when you
right.
pulled it out. So,
right.
yeah, so that's how we would do it. 50, 100, 150.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah. God.
Yeah. I remember Mario Ferrari giving his driver bags of rocks. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, then you can just toss them once they're
ready. Which driver, Reggie?
Well, who knows? He's, you know, Mario was creative, big time.
Yeah.
I love that guy. He had always badass cars, beautiful cars, good sponsors. Yeah, but yeah, bags of rocks. So they weigh 5 or 10 pounds, you just toss it when the thing. I thought that was a great idea. Yeah. Yeah.
So all right, besides the lead, what else were you screwing around with?
Well, the back then probably the biggest thing was the left side weight. The one night I made my car. There was a rule about the motor had to be like only an inch offset. Mm-hmm. And I made my A-frames like real big on the right side. And the rear, I made it like everybody was going nuttier and nuttier and nuttier. Mm-hmm. And it was really obvious if you looked at it. But they never teched you till after the race was over. And I was driving for Billy Graham. His name was actually the Whale, they called him.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on that car all week. He goes, well, what are you going to do if you win? I says, don't worry, I got a plan. He goes, what do you mean you got a plan? I said, listen, when I come, after I take the checkered flag and we do all the ceremonies, mm-hmm. when I'm pulling in the pits, I'm going to rip the right front right off the car. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to floor it and rip the right front suspension right off.
As you going out of the track?
Yeah.
At wall, I remember, because
yeah. yeah,
the wood wall's there.
Yeah, so
I know.
He goes, what? I says, yeah, what else you want me to do? They're going to DQ us. But unfortunately, I didn't get to win, so I never got to rip the right front suspension off.
My God,
yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
The speaking of like innovators or guys that were like smart or clever at building cars, like you raced with like all those guys, Richie, Maynard, you know, Mike Stefanik. What you've actually beat Mike Stefanik for the championship too, the championship you won, if I'm not
yes
mistaken.
In 1990. And also give a real quick thing with Mike Stefanik, Bill Potts told me we need to get better as a team back when I started driving for him.
Mm-hmm.
He said we got to go to Stafford Springs every Friday night and race.
Mm-hmm.
From New Jersey, which was, you know, with the traffic and everything on a Friday night.
It's a haul. Right.
We did it for 2 years.
You
got to
go through New York City.
Yep.
Yep.
So we did it for the 2 years. After I ran the first year, I says, these Troyer cars ain't no good here. I said, the guys that are running good, McLaughlin, Stefanik, and a couple others, I said, they all had switched to Richie Evans-style cars.
Mm-hmm.
So Stefanik had just started building his own cars. So I asked him, would you build me a car?
Mm-hmm.
And he did. He built me a great car. Matter of fact, so good that his father, not his father-in-law, his father-in-law would be the grandfather.
Okay.
The old man, Casella, the real old man,
mm-hmm.
told him, you better not build that car for Tomato. He'll beat you. And believe it or not, I ended up winning in a Stefanik car before Mike won a race in his own car.
In his
at
own
Stafford.
Car.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. After that, he won all the time. But that particular time, yeah, great car. And then I wrecked it the one night. I had to bring it back to him to get it fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandfather said, you better not put that on there straight, because he'll beat you again if you do.
He really was incredible all around, right?
Oh, my
driver, Lord. A car builder, just setup man, everything.
Yeah,
right?
Person. Yeah, all the way around. Great guy. Super, super person. Yep. But of course, he gave me the exact same car he had. And he knew if I beat him, I beat him because that particular day, I had a little better car than him or just outdrove him that particular day.
Right.
Like I said, it didn't happen a lot, but it happens sometimes.
Well, you had to do a lot of racing with him the year you won the championship, though, didn't
you? Yeah, positively, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I mean, he had a couple of wins that year. You won Monadnock.
That's all I
won. But you just wore him out with consistency.
Consistent finishes all the time.
Hold on, let me check my notes here. What is it, like 18 top 10 finishes, like out of 23 races or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yep. You see, the biggest thing of my racing career, which a lot of people don't realize, is I did this to support my family. This was my livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel a lot of times I had a better car than probably than I finished. But if I didn't finish, if I went for the win and got nothing compared to what I would have got for second or third, I felt in my heart, I made my day's pay. I'm in good shape here. I can survive another week until the next race. So I had to, you know, think about my family all the time, my whole life racing. Because how many people get to race their whole life and support their family and do what you want your whole life?
And you're still doing it, right? You're
still
racing
it.
To support yourself and everything. You've got the 99 car, right?
I'm fortunate enough all through the years. I accumulated enough stuff that I got my own cars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's no money to be made other than if you're Matt Hirschman. If you're a Matt Hirschman, old man Hirschman's category, God bless them, they're doing great. But for most of the people, everybody's happy just to break even.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? In this day and age. So,
are you happy that you're still racing now? I mean, obviously you were running full time up until a couple of years ago, and now
5 years ago, yeah,
now you've put a couple of different guys in the car. You've put Chase Dowling in, Ronnie Williams.
Yeah, that's it.
Who else have you had in your car?
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
Do you like the car owner aspect of it, or do you still just have fun driving?
I have fun driving, but if I'm lucky enough to have either Chase Dowling or Ronnie Williams drive my car, I'm even happier. They remind me of me when I was their age.
Mm-hmm.
And I see my car run right up front with the best of them. And I don't have all the fancier stuff that all the guys have now because I'm old school. I'm like the old man Hirschman. You know, everybody probably thinks Matt's car has got a lot of fancy stuff on it. As they realize now, it doesn't have a lot of fancy stuff on it, you know.
It's basic and they do their homework.
Exactly, yes. And I'm kind of that old school thing. And but when the Chase or Ronnie both got in my car, they never had a complaint, zero. And they both ran right up front every time they've raced my car.
Mm-hmm.
So I do get great satisfaction if I have a talented driver like them two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's very hard to find guys of their caliber that want to come and drive your car. And
you know, one of the things that really amazed me one time, and I was at South Boston, and Chase was driving your car.
Yep.
And I was listening in on the radio, and Chase is, at the time, I think he was, 18 or 19 years old. I don't even think he was 20. And one of the things that amazed me was listening to him talk with the crew chief on the radio of how he liked this, and the car was doing this, and he said, well, we don't have the springs for that. And he said, okay, he goes, just give me a couple of packers here, and I can compensate with this.
Right.
And he goes, now, at the end of the race, I want you to do this, and this. I was just amazed. Like, he was giving them setups, anticipating for where the car was going to go and what it was going to do, and just those things that you don't hear out of a 19-year-old. You know? It was really surprising and impressive at the same time to hear how the information he was giving and how he communicated.
Yeah, positively.
Yeah.
Yep.
It showed me really how good he is with setups on the car.
Yep.
So. And that's got to make you feel good knowing you're going into it with a shot.
Yes, positively. And when Chase first started driving for me, I learned things from him. A 60-year-old guy is learning stuff from a 20-year-old kid. And that's one reason right now when I go to New Hampshire to race with Ronnie Williams, my car runs up front because I paid attention to what he was doing. There's no way I would have figured any of that stuff out. Because I'm old school. Just the way they do things with the bump stop in a car, or coil bind in a car, or platform in a car. You know, I'm still old school where you just run 200s and 500s, kind of. That's just a standard deal. And at 200s and 500s, a car will go around any track at any time in a day. But to make it excel maybe a little bit better at a place like New Hampshire, you got to do some fancier stuff. And Chase had that fancier stuff. And I learned some stuff from him. And when I go up to New Hampshire, my car still runs right up front because I still got them notes.
You never stop learning.
No, positively.
You never do.
Positively.
But now, though, you're doing the Smart Modified Tour down here.
I've been running my own self, yes.
Right. How do you like the Smart Modified Tour? How do you like racing down here compared to running the Northern Tour for so many years?
It's a complete different thing. The tire situation down here, the tracks down south, most of them are worn out. And I understand why they're worn out is because they don't have the money to revamp the tracks and stuff. I understand that, which makes the racing very interesting and stuff. So, but I've never had to race at, so far there was five races, three of them that you don't hit the gas pedal. The slower you go, the faster that you'll go later on.
So, well, you mean saving tires?
Trying to save the tires. I mean, it's just, you know.
I come from the open wheel racing world where you've got 25 laps to get the job done.
Right.
Saturday night modified races, anywhere from 30 to 50 laps.
Right.
Does it aggravate you to know that you're going to get the green flag and go out there and just fiddle around for like three quarters of the race and then go?
Yeah, it's terrible. And I actually called Bobby Labonte.
And then when you do go, you don't even, sorry to interrupt you, and then when you do go, you don't know how much tire or, you know, car you have left to work with. I mean, that's got to get frustrating too.
Yes, it is. Like, and Bobby Labonte, I was talking to him about it, and he said the same thing. He said, this is the stupidest thing I ever seen in my life, that you can't touch the gas pedal, that everybody's going 40, 50 miles an hour. You know, I mean, that's the sad part about it. I'd rather see the races shorter of a distance where you knew the tire physically could make that amount of laps. You know what I'm saying?
Do you miss the days of the tour being heat races in like a 50 to 80 lap main event?
Oh, positively.
Really?
See, now back in the day when it first started, we used to have 40-lap races,
right.
You know? At New Hampshire, we had 40-lap races. And then most of the races were 100-lap races, not, you know, 150 or 200 and stuff. And there was, you know, very little tire changing and stuff, you know? That's one thing that hurts the tour is trying to get enough people to go with the competitors. When you go away from your local home track or, you know, within your vicinity,
yeah,
the traveling part about it and stuff, that's very hard. You know, in the old days, there was plenty of people that wanted to go. In today's day and era, it's very hard to get a group of people.
Why do you think that is?
I just think there's so much more going on in life and trying to be a commitment to your family and stuff. You know,
right. Like we're busier than ever.
Yep. I noticed somehow or another the Hirschman family, that they go race, they got the same group of guys. And I told my son, man, he doesn't know how lucky he is. Them guys are committed to him, you know, like they're committed. I know on the Whalen Modified Tour, a lot of the big teams actually have paid crew chiefs and stuff now.
Right.
And not for pennies. I mean, for a good salary. And they deserve it. There's no doubt in my mind. The amount of hours it is to work on a car to get it ready to go race, it's people would say you're completely crazy. You're working on that car all them hours, and you're going to go out there and maybe have a good day and finish fifth, and you're going to make $1,200 when you just spent $3,000 on stuff? Are you completely nuts?
We do it because we love it.
Right, exactly. Yes.
I know. Yep. You know, and I can definitely see that with you guys because you guys show up to the track and your daughter has played crew chief at times.
Right. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I got my grandsons on my pit crew and stuff.
Okay.
You know, so I got my two sons, my daughter, and my two grandsons. And lucky, my grandsons got little guys their age, they come and they help too. So
that's cool.
Yeah, it is. It's really great.
Your grandson hasn't asked about driving.
Oh, no. He sits in a car every day. He's waiting to. But I told him, I'm not moving the seat. When you fit in my car, when you fit in it, then we're going to go to the track.
What about go-karts or something like that?
All that stuff costs money. Everything costs money.
Okay.
I know the modified. Okay. By the back of my hand. I got the stuff already. Okay. I don't have to invest any more money. Mm-hmm. Okay. Get in the car. If you got your balls are going to be big enough to try this thing,
right,
we'll go to the track. So,
that's good.
And every week he definitely gets taller. So before you know it, another tomato might be behind the wheel.
So now how many cars have you got now? You've got the Troyer car and...
I got two Troyer cars.
I thought you had a PSR chassis or...
Oh, no, that deal fell through for me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, did you drive one for...
No, I did not, no.
Oh, okay.
No,
so you got your two Troyer cars.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And... both used on the Southern Tour, or are you going to run any modified tour races this
year? My one authentic Troyer car that I'm putting together right now is brand spanking new for Ronnie Williams for New Hampshire.
Okay.
Yes, so that car will be just going to New Hampshire. And then my other car, which was at New Hampshire last year, that finished fourth in a race last year there, mm-hmm. that car is the one I'm using down south. And then anytime Ronnie Williams wants to come down south to race, then, okay. of course, he gets the wheel, you know.
What is your opinion on these... we're seeing more and more of these open modified events come, the bigger money events and things like that, the non-NASCAR events that have happened at Stafford, at New Hampshire, you know, things like that. What's your opinion on them?
Well, there's a lot of guys get to go to them, like New Hampshire Speedway had a race. They didn't have a big drawing at all, mm-hmm. unfortunately. But there's guys that got to go there and race where they would have never got to go there and race because the Whalen Modified Tour is pretty strict on their rules and regulations, and you're having a drug test. You know, different aspects that you got to go through, having the right components in your car and stuff.
Safety stuff.
All the safety stuff. Okay. And I understand their deal. I understand that 100%. Mm-hmm. But the other tours, see, the other tours actually got it made because of the Whalen Modified Tours. Because I would say last week at Stafford, there was, let's say, 40 cars there. I guarantee you probably 30 of them would have met the requirements of a Whalen Modified Tour race, even though they don't go. Mm-hmm. Because everybody in the back of their mind has, I'm going to run a Whalen Modified Tour race. I want to go to Martinsville.
Right.
And this is in April where they're saying it. Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to October, they don't go. But they bought the right stuff because in April they had the money.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I got you.
So
I also remember back in the day, too, when the Modified Tour came to town, you had your Modified Tour regulars, and then you had your local guys that would go up against the tour.
Yes.
You know, like if you went to Riverside Park, you had your guys like Bruce D'Alessandro or Brad Hytella or one of those,
right.
you know, those guys that would go up against the
Paul
tour.
Paul Berry, right?
Yeah, go down to Riverhead and you had your Harbacks and your Dan Giovinellis and your Baldwins and,
yes.
you know, guys like that that would yep. try to make the tour race.
Right, so you got your...
And it was huge for like a local guy to make the tour race, you know,
right,
you're in the show.
Right, so you had 20 Whalen guys... or whatever, Winston Modified guys back then. So you had 20 regulars of them show up. Then you had 20 Riverhead guys. Mm-hmm. Well, and then you only take 18 cars at a time. Well, that was the first time I ever didn't make a race. Mm-hmm. I didn't qualify. Mm-hmm. And back then, they didn't have no past champ provisionals. So I physically went home. I didn't get the race in
from,
a race.
From Riverhead?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was that your toughest track? Because a lot of guys on the tour have always said like places like Riverhead was always the hardest.
Riverhead was the hardest because it was small and the track needed to be paved back then. Mm-hmm. Now they paved it. Mm-hmm. So I know the track, from what I'm told, is way better. But
well,
yeah.
you've run on it in the last couple of years,
No, not since
you?
It's been paved.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
okay.
It's been paved. But before they paved it, it was a handful coming off of turn two with a bump and the car twisting all the time.
Was that your toughest track that you've ever run on, Riverhead?
As the years went, yes. Yeah, believe it or not, the first year they had the tour there, I got the pole. I was leading the race. I would have won, and I got a flat
really?
With about 10 laps to go.
Okay.
You know, it was the hardest track to qualify out because of the regular guys were so good at their home track, mm-hmm. you know?
How often did you come to Long Island? Like, you've run at Islip, obviously.
Yes,
right?
I went to Islip in 80. Yep.
Okay.
Thank goodness. Yep.
What was your take on the Long Island tracks? Because that's where I'm from. You know, I remember Islip, Freeport,
Riverhead. Well, yes. I only got to go to Islip twice. So And that's 1980. So mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to go there and qualify and be in the race. I mean, that was the main objective back then. Right. You know,
and Charlie was the hot. He was the
oh
hot
yeah,
shot.
Yeah, yeah, he was right. the hot shot. Yeah, no. yeah.
Exactly. How much did you have an interaction with him? Did you have any kind of relationship with Charlie?
Oh yeah, I used to have what we call him red eye at Martinsville Speedway at the Dutch Inn. Mm-hmm. As soon as you got back to the Dutch Inn, you went to the bar, and I'm sitting next to Charlie. I said, "What the hell are you drinking?" I said, "It's red." He goes, "It's a red eye." I said, "A red eye? What kind of beer is that?" He goes, "No, no, it's a beer, but I put tomato juice in it." I said, "Tomato juice?" I said, "Let me try one of them things." And believe it or not, till this today, I still drink them things with really? The tomato juice in it. And a lot of people down south also drink that.
Red eye.
It's called a red eye.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, red eye.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a beer drinker to begin with. I like my liquor.
But he was down to earth. I mean, if Charlie's appearance would scare any young guy, for as big of a guy he is,
right.
you mm-hmm. know, and it's just mean look he had on his car, his face all the time, you know. So the race against him and old man Baldwin in a race, as soon as the race started, like even though I could be faster than them, like, I said, man, should I hit this guy? Should I touch him? I don't know. They're going to get mad. You know, you had to think about it because these right. guys have kicked the shit out of you after the race.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Look, right. I understand. Believe me, I'm 5'7".
Right,
you know, 150 right. pounds.
I remember the one night Ball was chasing me around my car, you know, trying to get a hold. I'll kill you, he kept on saying. I'll kill you.
Was he one of your biggest rivals?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, positively.
He was?
Yeah, he was so determined to be the best of the best.
Right.
So when, you know, you beat him, he'd have, though, the next day after you beat him, he'd call you up on the phone. Tomato, what do you have in the car? And if you lie to me, I'll get in my car right now. I'll come down to Jersey and kick the shit out of you. What did you have in your car?
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, my
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
No kidding.
He was priceless all the time. Great. And he was, you know, and he always spoke his mind, mm-hmm. you know? To stand up to NASCAR mm-hmm. all the time, you know. And right before he passed away, he was trying to get his own tour started, which I'm sure he would have done a great job of running it, you know, because he would have made sure.
He didn't take any crap.
No, at yeah. all, zero. So mm-hmm. he was way ahead of trying to, these other guys doing their own tours and stuff.
So coming from that Wall Stadium era, too, you also saw, you know, Ray Evernham in his early years.
Yes.
I guess you could say. Did you race with Ray in the Sportsman's too? Because he ran Sportsman's as well, didn't
no,
he?
No, I started before Ray started racing. So he was always behind. Mm-hmm. And then finally, he finally went modified. I was already modified. But to make a long story short with Ray Evernham, we became real good friends. Actually, best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And 1980, 81, Norwegian Speedway needed their pace car brought down to Daytona. Okay. So I said, Ray, we can drive their pace car. We can go to Daytona.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go? He goes, yeah, 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 let's go. Well, not even thinking about nothing. So we get their Norwegian pace car. We get to drive it to Daytona. They paid the...
You and Ray Evernham.
Me and Ray Evernham.
This is getting right? good. Okay.
Okay. Well, we get to Daytona. Here's the car. See you later. What do you mean, see you later? What? Where do we go? Where do we stay? What are you talking about? That's your job. We let you guys bring the car to Daytona.
Yeah.
That was it.
You didn't make any hotel arrangements or nothing?
Well, who threw whatever? We're young kids. We wanted to go to Daytona. Okay.
What'd you think? You had a place to stay?
Well, you don't even think. You just know where you're getting to Daytona. So now we're screwed. And we probably only had $100 between both of us. We were millionaires.
How old were you and Ray at the time?
20. So that's 45. 20 years old. I was probably
really?
20. He was probably 18 or something.
Wow.
Right? So thank goodness I knew more people than Ray back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into Eddie Bohm. I said, Eddie, do you have some place you're staying? He goes, yeah, I got this little motel, a little dive. Me and my buddy are you're staying in it. I said, what do you mean little? He goes, I don't know. It's 10 by 10. It's a one little teeny room. I said, listen, me and my buddy, we got to stay there because we got nowhere to stay and we ain't got no money. He goes, oh, yeah, come over. You can sleep on the floor. So for 2 weeks, we slept on Eddie Bone's floor at his motel room.
Oh, my God.
But them 2 weeks of time that we stayed down there, you could have never replaced it. You could have made a movie.
What'd you do down there?
Just have fun.
Have fun. Did you go racing or did you just
we
go
went
party?
There. We went there just to bring the car there, basically to party. Mm-hmm. But the one morning, I'm laying at this, after a long night out, I'm laying at the motel, like on the back by the pool. And Maynard Troyer comes up. He goes, "Tomato, what are you doing?" And, oh, I said, "It was a bad night. Bad. I still don't feel good." He goes, "Get up and come with me." I said, "Maynard Troyer." So I go with him. He goes, "Get in my car." I says, "Get in your race car." He goes, "Yeah, get in." He goes, "How do you fit?" I says, "How do I fit?" He goes, "How do you fit in the seat?" I says, "I don't know. It's way too big for me." He goes, "Well, I want you to drive it tonight." I said, "You want me to drive your car at New Smyrna tonight?" Mm-hmm. He goes, "Yeah, how do you fit?" I said, "If I'm driving this car, I fit perfect." The seat was so big when I was racing a Smyrna, I would slide underneath like the pedals and then slide back up coming off the corner. There was no way I could ever.
Maynard looked a little thicker than you.
Yeah. It was nuts. I held on to that steering wheel for dear life because if I let go, I would have flew out of the car.
Right.
And I got to drive his car for 2 nights down there because he wanted to see it physically race during a race and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but believe it or not, I looked up in the record books back then. All they do is they have Maynard Troyer starting the races because they didn't have nobody like yourself going around seeing who's driving and stuff.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but I got to drive for him 2 nights down there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Going back, though, with you and Ray, like watching him build cars and race over the years, did you know right from the beginning like he had a mind that worked different than other people when it comes to race car setups and everything?
Well, Ray Evraham wrote an article in Ariana Racing News, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months ago, maybe might dig it up. Mm-hmm. There was a big article on him. And as the years went by, we disconnected, kind of. And when I saw this article, I says, "I wonder if that son of a bitch is going to say anything about me in this article." And lo and behold, I finally got to the part, my name was in there. I says, "Son of a bitch, he's actually going to say something, huh?" See, Ray, I used to set race cars up. I did all Ray's setups. Okay. I taught Ray a lot mm-hmm. of stuff because I was fortunate enough to have somebody smarter than me teach me. Mm-hmm. And Ray needed me. Matter of fact, he needed me so much that the car I won Turkey Derby with in 81, which I should have never, ever sold, I sold to Ray. He won his first modified feature in that car. Guess who finished second that night to him? I did. He beat me in that car.
That was the Howard Harvey car?
Yeah, that was the Howard Harvey car.
Okay.
And now I was driving a new Howard Harvey car. But he beat me in the race. Howard Harvey said to me, "You let him win that race because you're friends." I says, "Are you completely nuts? There is no way in hell I would let him win." He had that car. I should have never sold him. He has that car.
That was the 19 car, the Bama Farms
car?
Yeah,
that's the one that ended up blowing up at Martinsville and exploding and stuff.
With Tony Siscone.
Yes, exactly.
Were you there for that?
Yeah, I was in a race. I finished fourth. Of course.
Did you see it happen?
Listen, guess who drove Ray Evraham home from that race?
You did.
I did. Because I had a cube van like Richie Evans with a bed in it. And he needed to lay down for the trip home. So other than taking an ambulance or flying, I kicked everybody out of my truck and he laid down in the bed all the way back to New Jersey and stuff.
Wow.
But yeah.
Yeah, I saw the video of it. And obviously I saw the photo sequence of it in stock car racing from back in the day. Yeah, Ray, I remember Ray getting out of the car first.
Yes.
He was one of the first ones to get out. And Tony was second, but by then he had already burned up his hands, right?
Bad, yes. But getting back to Ray, though, when we were younger, I lived only 10 miles less than that to Wall Stadium. Mm-hmm. But my town was a different town. But I lived right on the border. Mm-hmm. And I lived far away from the police station in this town called Tinton Falls. Mm-hmm. the cops would always be getting phone calls and I'm making a lot of noise at my parents' house. Mm-hmm. I ended up knowing all the cops. The cops used to come there to hide at nighttime because they knew I'd be working on the car all night, and they would come and hang out because they were 20 miles away from the police station,
right,
and stuff, you know? Well, the one day, the best cop I knew in town said, Jamie, do you know IROC is coming to Tenton Falls? Now, this is back, not many people knew racing or knew IROC or nothing. Mm-hmm. I says, what are you talking about? I says, why would they come to this town, Tenton Falls? He goes, I'm telling you, there's an industrial park. I'll take you to it. They're going to move into Tenton Falls, the IROC series. I said, the IROC series, that big-ass thing that should be down south, is going to be in New Jersey and my town.
Right.
He goes, yeah. He goes, and not only that, they need somebody to run it. I said, what? No shit. I says, wow. I says, I know a lot about racing. You know, this is all I wanted to do my whole life. He goes, well, you need to get over there tomorrow. I talked to the guy, told him about you. Get your ass over there and talk to this guy. So I go
over
there.
Was it Jay Signore?
Jay Signore, of course.
Okay.
On that day I'm going over there, Everham shows up at my shop. I says, I'm going over to this place, IROC. I'm going to see about getting a real job at this place. He goes, I'll take a ride with you. I said, okay, take a ride, whatever. So I'm in there having my meeting and doing all the stuff, talking my racing shit, you know, because I've been doing it now for 6-7 years, more so than most people, mm-hmm. you know. And basically the guy says, the job's yours. I said, oh, super. I says, when do I start? He goes, well, you got to start such and such. I says, oh, I can't start then. I got to race. He said, race? He says, you can't race no more. I said, what do you mean I can't race no more? He goes, no, you got to be here full time, round the clock. This is a big, big operation. You know, you don't have any time to go race no more.
Right. It's I said, your whole life is now dedicated to preparing these cars.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, this ain't for me. See you later. The next day, Ray Everham went back.
Wow. And the rest is history.
Yep.
Wow. Well, you know, Jamie, we got to wrap it up, but I want to thank you for coming on the show. I'm sure that you have millions of other stories that you can share with us. I've told a lot of guys in the past, we got to have you back again.
Gotcha. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Jamie Tomaino joins us today on the Derek Pernasiglio Show. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you the next time. Bye.